What happens if we flip the traditional way of sharing medical information to the wider population on its head? What happens if instead of letting algorithms or the zeitgeist of the moment order our social media feeds, we go straight to the source of clinical medicine and ask practicing experts what they see day in, day out, and give them an unedited platform to help disseminate practical medical information straight from the specialist? So welcome, Dr. Nick Walsh, to Straight from the Specialist. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm really pleased to be here.
We arranged this quite a few months ago, so I've been looking forward to an ADHD recording, and I've spoken to my friends, some are secondary school teachers. I was speaking to an English literature teacher, I think GCSE level, and she was saying how she notices certain traits in students, but I'm so interested to understand how we can help using this recording, but also how other allied healthcare professionals and educationalists can help with understanding what ADHD is and then being able to prompt people to access services. So I hope that this will be a useful recording, not just to healthcare workers, but others as well. So thanks for coming.
Oh, no, you're really welcome. And yeah, I think there's a lot of, as much as there's a lot of discussion about ADHD, and that's what you'll hear in the media, isn't it? Oh, it's everyone's talking about ADHD. But actually, there are a lot of people don't understand ADHD, and there are a lot of misconceptions about what it is, what it looks like. Mm. It's not that obvious, I don't think, from
the
definition.
Well, I think I was struck by the fact that you're saying that you've quoted the prevalence as being...
In adults, it's estimated to be between 3 and 5% of the adult population.
And yet you're saying as a specialist that... We still need to do an introduction, by the way. But you're saying as a specialist, it's still underdiagnosed in the UK.
Yes, and we have lots of evidence that it is underdiagnosed. And a few years ago, and I don't know if this statistic is still quoted, but the statistic was that 90% of adults with ADHD do not know they have ADHD. Wow. And it probably hasn't changed that much, even though, you know, there has been a significant rise in diagnoses. Probably most people don't know they have ADHD.
Wow. So even though there's a lot of social media, so this is why I think this recording is really useful. So Nick, could you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, so I'm a consultant in adult psychiatry, and I subspecialise in liaison psychiatry, which is the kind of overlap between physical and mental health. So most of my work when I was in the NHS was actually in general hospital settings, so where people would go with a physical injury or illness. And now I work in private practice, and my practice has really developed and really focuses on really neurodivergence, so primarily ADHD and autism in adults, particularly women, and also the kind of mental health conditions that go along with it. So I don't just kind of assess for ADHD, I see people with mental health problems, and they're all kind of connected. And so a lot of people who come to me don't necessarily come looking or asking for an ADHD or autism assessment. They come with maybe OCD or anxiety or trauma symptoms.
Treatment-resistant depression.
Yes, depression hasn't got better. Yeah. And then as we talk about it, it emerges that, well, perhaps they may have ADHD or autism, and so it may be me that's suggesting it. And so my experience is quite specific, but it does show that, you know, people are not necessarily going to get an ADHD assessment.
So they're not self-seeking.
Not necessarily. Yeah. But I also find that, I mean, some people do say that that's what they're looking for and explain why. But a lot of people actually, even if they think maybe they do have it, they don't want to say. They're quite reluctant.
Why do you think there's a hesitancy there to get a diagnosis or a label from the patient's perspective?
Well, I think it's perhaps about this idea that you shouldn't believe what you see on social media, and that the doctor is going to say, you know, well, you shouldn't believe that, or you shouldn't diagnose yourself. Some people are hesitant to say what they think it might be. I have to really say, well, I really would be helpful to understand what you think, so that if I think it's not that, I can explain why, and if I do think it is. But actually, most people, if people they think they may have ADHD, they usually do. I mean, because there's a lot of really helpful information available. And also people have often been experiencing problems for a long time. It's not the first thing that people think of. And it's very difficult to get an ADHD assessment. So it's not that people are just thinking, oh, maybe I've got ADHD, I'm going to go and get that assessed. That's not my experience, that they've often had lots of different treatments that haven't really worked. They've been struggling with their mental health for a long time. And I see people in their 40s, 50s. I mean, I've diagnosed somebody who was late 60s. I see people over the age of 18. So I see a whole range of people. So some people are young and, you know, have quite clear that they think they may have ADHD from an early age. But a lot of people come later, particularly women who get diagnosed around perimenopause. And they will probably have had difficulties with anxiety or depression, but not necessarily significant problems. But then when they go into perimenopause, then that's when symptoms really become clear. So there's a lot of reasons why people might come later. But ADHD, just, I don't think it is the first thing that people think of.
Thank you for your introduction. So the format of the recording is based on three questions, sorry, but it's a conversation. So I'll annoyingly interrupt with questions, if you don't mind. So the three questions are, from your area of expertise as a specialist, what would you like to share with the general population?
Okay.
Level two is with GP colleagues. And then three is, what would you like to share with your specialist colleagues? I would like to focus on ADHD, but please feel free to talk about connected disorders and the other associated conditions. So let's start with, what would you like to share with the general population?
So I think really what I see in my practice is that there is still a lot of misunderstanding of what ADHD is, really. It's usually people that I've seen who I think, oh, I think they may have ADHD, and that they don't think that. And when I suggest it or kind of talk about it in general terms, they don't initially think that that's what it is. Because what they think is ADHD is not what I'm looking at. It's not, or maybe, so it's not that people think they have ADHD and I'm saying, no, that's not ADHD. It's usually that they do have ADHD, because most of the time we do the assessment, you know, and then they kind of understand. So it's, you know, there's a whole journey of kind of starting to understand that you might have ADHD and kind of coming to terms with it, because it's quite a big thing. So it's, you know, I'm always very cautious initially about whether to suggest it and how to suggest it, and how, depending on, you know, the things that have come up in the consultation, what we focus on. And I'm really led by, some people don't really want to go down that route, so they want to focus on the other difficulties they've come with, and that's fine, that's what we'll do.
What are those difficulties, say, for example, that they come with? Because when we were prepping for this, you were talking about treatment-resistant depression. You know, they've struggled, and that's why it takes them a few decades maybe to come and find a diagnosis. How do they present to you?
Yeah, so we tend to use the term difficult to treat depression nowadays, because I think the phrase treatment resistant depression can sometimes make people feel like that they've not got better and they should have got better.
Thanks for correcting me.
Well, I think people can feel that, you know, the doctor is kind of feeling that they should have got better because you've had these treatments. And I think there's a kind of
responsibility.
Yes, and I think people think they should have got better. And that's my understanding of why the term has kind of shifted. Okay. So maybe then, you know, maybe other explanations and other reasons. Yeah. But depression which hasn't responded or hasn't got better. So yes, people who've had mental health problems, particularly anxiety and depression, which have started in often quite early life, so around teenage years, sometimes before they're a teenager, or perhaps, you know, in the early 20s as well. And but particularly anxiety or depression that hasn't got better. So maybe they've had different types of psychological treatment, they may have had different medications, often with their GP, and they may never have seen a psychiatrist, or perhaps seen a psychiatrist once before, and, you know, they still haven't really got better. or they got better for a bit and then it came back, or they've had things like OCD or PTSD, for example. And people who are neurodivergent are much more likely to have mental health problems in general, but particularly kind of anxiety, depression, and PTSD. Then people are more likely to be exposed to traumatic events, but also the experience, the day-to-day experience from childhood of being neurodivergent and not recognised as that. People have very invalidating experiences, and maybe more likely to be bullied and excluded by their peers, have difficulties at school, be in trouble at home, lots of things that can be quite distressing, but where they, because it's not identified that if they've got a difficulty that is explainable and they need support with, then they internalise, well, I'm doing something wrong, I'm not good enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not working hard enough, I'm not remembering things, I'm losing things, you know, that people get quite negative views about themselves, and then there are slightly, you know, linked but different experiences with autism as well, of kind of in this social kind of social life. And people often come with other difficulties, that, and maybe they want to focus on that if they're, you know, not sure whether they may have ADHD or it doesn't, they don't recognize it. It's really important for people to recognize it.
Yeah.
So the first thing I would say to people, whether it's an initial conversation or when we make the diagnosis after the assessment, is learn about it. Learn about it and how it affects you, because we only have time to talk about a certain number of symptoms or traits, and actually the adult ADHD assessment is relatively narrow. We know it doesn't really include things like emotional symptoms because they're not part of the diagnostic criteria, although they almost certainly will be when they're reviewed. So there are lots of symptoms of ADHD that aren't really, that we know are symptoms, that aren't included in the assessment. So it's really important that people recognise it. And so what I would say to people, if we have that initial discussion where I'm thinking maybe you do have ADHD as well as, you know, the anxiety or the other problem that they've come with, is think about it, look it up online, and if you maybe do the screening forms, if that resonates with you and it chimes with you, then maybe we can think about whether you want to go forward. If you think, no, this doesn't really make sense to me, this is not helpful to me to understand things in this way, then it's not helpful to you. It's got to make sense, it's got to be helpful to the person.
And to have confidence in your almost intuition of whether, you know, you want it, seems useful, or it doesn't. Have confidence.
Yes, I think from my point of view, the purpose of the assessment needs to be to help the person understand themselves better. So if it doesn't make sense to them and it's not going to be helpful, then there's, I don't think that's the purpose in going through it, because it can cause more distress. Because it is a diagnosis that does carry stigma, actually. And there is a lot of stigma about ADHD. excuse me, that it's still prevalent. So as much as there is a lot of discussion about ADHD on social media and more broadly, there is a lot of stigma about it.
Why do you think there's so much interest in social media about ADHD? Because it seems as though the way they're portraying it, as though everybody wants a diagnosis, and it's overdiagnosed. But in fact, you're giving me the numbers and you're saying 1 in 9 people actually get a formal diagnosis of ADHD. Is that correct?
Who have ADHD, yes.
Yeah.
And that figure probably will change, but hopefully.
So there are still 8 people out of 9.
Who don't know that they have it. And maybe they think they might think they have it, but they've not got a diagnosis. We don't know. And that is particularly likely to be women, because women are particularly underdiagnosed compared to men. So women and girls are underdiagnosed compared to boys and men, and that is being slightly corrected, and it is probably partly why there are a lot more referrals for assessment, because it is being picked up more. So part of that is just equalizing the number of women and men or boys and girls, because there isn't really, there's no difference in the rate between the genders.
Yeah.
But it's just that women were just not identified. So there's a big disparity there. So there are certainly not more referrals for assessments than you might expect looking at the population. I mean, there's also a difference between overdiagnosing something and misdiagnosing. So in an individual, yes, that might not be the correct diagnosis. That's always possible, mm-hmm. Because diagnosis is never 100% accurate in every single person. So it's possible that people have been told they have ADHD when they don't, or not, or told they don't have ADHD when they do. Mm. But that's not the same as it being overdiagnosed in the whole population. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's really clear from the there's a recent NHS England report on that, and with the figures that are available. It's not in a opinion, although it's often presented as a. There's a lot of opinion that it is overdiagnosed, even from professionals, and that you do see that in the media, but the statistics don't reflect that.
I mean, I want to ask two questions mm-hmm. now. What's the importance of getting a diagnosis for those that may be hesitant?
Mm.
Yeah, that's and a, for the yeah. rest of the population to understand mm. why is it important to signpost some individuals mm. into seeking?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So firstly, as I said, I think to understand it's a long-term condition. It starts in early life. So the difficulties from ADHD may not be obvious in childhood. The symptoms should be there, but they may not be causing a lot of problems. And it may be later that problems become clearer. But usually people have had difficulties for a long time and they've not had an explanation for them. And because the symptoms of ADHD or the traits of ADHD, they're all individually completely ordinary experiences. We've all forgotten our wallet occasionally, or been late, or been kind of stressed waiting for something and kind of fidgeting, tapping our feet. That's all these, we've all been impatient in a queue, these things that most people experienced at times, but they cluster together in ADHD and cause a lot of impairment in various different aspects of life. But because they're kind of ordinary experiences in themselves, I think if you don't have the diagnosis, it's very hard to understand what it's happening. And also people around you will be thinking and reacting like, well, that's not a problem. That's just normal. And so people are somehow aware, usually, that they're finding things quite difficult, but everybody else seems to be doing the same thing and they're okay. So why can't I do it? And they don't know. So having that explanation can be incredibly helpful. And that's, it's actually why I really love doing my work, because it is or can be really life-changing. It can be really powerful. It's often very moving when someone has this assessment and really starts to understand. Because first of all, they can let go or start to let go of some of the kind of negative views about themselves and the shame, like, frankly, that goes along with it, of not being good enough and not being able to do these things that everyone else can do. Mm. Other people aren't late for school, other people aren't late for work, other people don't forget things all the time. Why can't I do it? And so that's really powerful. But then also, once you know what it is that's causing the problem, then you can do something about it. Whatever that is, whatever treatment option you think is right for you, if you don't know what the problem is, how you're just being kind of buffeted around by a storm. Really, that's how I kind of think of it. But once you understand this is happening because of these things, then you can put strategies in place to manage. And even just understanding it relieves a lot of distress.
So, I mean, you're talking about on an individual level.
Yeah.
That it alleviates a lot of the shame, the anxieties, and the dysfunction, or the dysfunction that other people think that you have and you yourself believe you have. But on a societal level, having a diagnosis and making sure that people have access to therapies and interventions, does that help society?
Yes, I think so.
You were talking about people who have been imprisoned.
So, yeah, that we do have statistics that there are very high rates of ADHD in prison populations. Mm. And, I mean, it's not my area of expertise specifically, but I know that there are studies which have shown that if you treat people with ADHD, with imprisoned with ADHD, the rate of recidivism or committing further offences after release is much, much lower. Mm. So, that's one group of people who are actually quite vulnerable, who can really benefit from treatment, and, because those people can build a different life. So there is the societal benefit in terms of crime and, prison populations. I mean, and more broadly, both for the person and for society, there are, I think you can see similar benefits in that health outcomes for people with ADHD are much worse than the population, both physical health and mental health we've spoken about a little already. But physical illnesses, people with ADHD are much more likely to have heart disease, addictions, obesity. There are lots of problems that, you know, long-term health problems. And there are a number of studies, and there was one very recently which showed that, I don't want to alarm people, but if you have untreated ADHD, there is a risk of dying younger than the rest of the population from illness or accident. But treating ADHD reduces or eliminates that difference. So, and people are able to fulfill their potential, whatever that is. And I think that's the way to think about it, rather than have a kind of set measure of the impairment. It's more about the whether someone can meet their own potential, which is important for them, but it's important for everybody, for society. It's because there are people have overall, with people with ADHD, have much more difficulty in employment and difficulty with relationships. So it's obviously very variable, and it's extremely individual in terms of how ADHD affects somebody. There's a huge variety of, you know, the ways that it can affect people. And it can change over time. On overall, for at the population level, we know that it has big impacts on healthcare, physical health, mental health, employment, relationships. But so having treatment is really important, or being able to access that.
Or having the choice.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And some people are able to compensate and work around their difficulties, and they're in a situation where perhaps their traits aren't being triggered, if you like, because the setting that you're in has a big impact. And that's why in adulthood, symptoms or the difficulty with ADHD appears to change over time.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So, you know, if, for example, a common difficulty with attention is putting things off, having difficulty with detailed tasks, things that might take a long time where you have to concentrate if it's not interesting. So doing filling in forms or writing reports. So if your job involves lots of reading of long documents and summarising them or writing them, that is a particularly difficult thing to do if you have ADHD, unless you are very interested in that area of work. So if that is your job, then that's more likely to cause you a problem. If you're doing a job where it's very kind of immediate, you do something and it's finished, or it's project-based where it's got deadlines, that's the other thing. Deadlines are incredibly helpful. So if you're doing a project-based job where there are fixed deadlines, and then you move on to do something else, which is a bit different, so it's kind of novel and stimulating, that may cause you less difficulties than if you're given a piece of work, write this report, it's due in 6 months, you just get on with it. That's incredibly difficult if you've got ADHD, if no one's kind of checking in, or you don't have to go to discussions, or, you know, it's really, really hard to get that done. So a lot of people with ADHD will find that they're doing their university dissertations quite late, late on. So working to needing a deadline, always doing things at the last minute, it's the pressure of the deadline is what helps people to focus and get started. Whereas if it's an open-ended or it's a long way away, it's really hard to start it.
So if your patients are 40, they know this about themselves through trial and error, through failing at one job and then, going and finding another path. But it is useful to know as a teenager, if you're career planning, if you're looking at what university degree to pursue. It's useful to understand what your brain type is like, so you can plan accordingly, right? Is that one of the advantages of getting an early diagnosis?
Yeah, I think so. And I think for anybody, because even if it's been, you may have had these issues with moving to different jobs, and you may be in your 40s, but you you may not have framed it in that way. You may have understood that something else was happening, and it may well have been happening because there's, you know, there's different ways to explain things.
Still not might have insight.
You may not have put it together in that way to see, well, this is why. You may know that you've moved, but because you've lost interest in something, or for other reasons. And that, you know, there may be lots of things happening because, you know, maybe you had a family and you moved, or you separated and you moved. You know, you might have, there may be other things that necessitated changing roles, or things just seem to happen kind of naturally. So it's not always that obvious until, you know, but I'm looking at a particular way of kind of putting things together and seeing, well, is there a different pattern here that might add something to this, but to help people. But absolutely understanding what are your strengths and kind of working to them.
Not just your weaknesses.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's really important to kind of try and work to your strengths. And if you can then be in a situation where, you know, your work is focused on things which you're naturally good at and you enjoy, then that's better. I mean, that's better for anybody, but it's particularly helpful with ADHD. And generally, you know, trying to set your life up in that way will make things easier. And some people, you know, haven't managed to find that.
They need more guidance.
And more kind of structure. And medication can be, you know, extremely helpful.
Mm-mm. So in summary,
I think that ADHD is often not as obvious as people think it might be. It's not about whether you can concentrate or not concentrate. It's really about people with ADHD can concentrate very well if it's interesting, if they're enjoying it.
Hyper-focus.
Yes, and people can, to the extent they may lose track of time. But if it's boring, it's difficult, and that's usually something you've got to do, like a tax return, for example, is the classic one for an adult, and struggling to know, well, why do I find these things difficult? So a lot of people say, yes, I can concentrate. And so, okay, well, tell me a bit more about that. Mm-hmm. And actually, they can concentrate well in certain situations. And so they think, well, because I can concentrate, I don't have ADHD. Similarly with the kind of restlessness and fidgeting, people may not recognize the hyperactivity because it can be things like biting your fingernails, doodling with a pen in a meeting, or feeling like you want to get up and move around, shifting around in your seat. If you're doing that a lot, then that may be a symptom of ADHD. Obviously, there are lots of reasons that might be happening, but if it's a consistent thing, that's part of who you are, then it's more likely that it's perhaps linked to ADHD. And things like being impatient. So this is one which often comes up, actually, when we're doing the assessment, where one of the questions is about having difficulty waiting for your turn for something. I'm okay being in a queue. Nobody really likes being in a queue. And then I'll say, well, some people aren't bothered at all if they're in a queue. And then people will say, oh, okay. Because it's so ordinary to them and so kind of instinctive that being in a queue is really frustrating and annoying. You put up with it because you have to be in a queue, but you don't really want to be. So they don't necessarily think that they have difficulty waiting their turn. And they don't on one level, but but in terms of this question,
when you specifically,
they do.
Yeah, and
so this is, again, part of why it's difficult to know whether you maybe have ADHD, because some of these experiences, they're so
normal.
Intrinsic. Yes, you've always had them. And people assume that if they're doing something that they can see other people doing, that the internal experience is the same. And so people just think, well, everybody has the same internal experience, which is natural, but not everyone does. And so this is why it's really hard to know that you're experiencing something different until someone explains not everybody has this experience. Mm-hmm. And when you have a number of those things together, I was actually reading something yesterday, which I'd seen before, about inner monologue. And there's a psychologist who did a study, and he showed, and I don't know if there have been other studies, but this study showed that between a third and a half of people do not have an inner monologue. Most people from the study will assume that everyone has whatever. If they don't have that inner monologue, they assume no one does. And if they do, they assume everyone does. And people are really confused when you say, well, not everyone has this.
Yeah.
And they don't understand because it's so intrinsic to how they experience things. And I think ADHD is a bit like that. So it's really hard if that's the experience you've always had and no one's ever said, well, not everyone has this because no one's asked. How would you know that that's not what everyone has? And this is why I think it's hard to know that you have it sometimes.
It's not easy to diagnose. Because what you're saying on some level, it's a cluster of symptoms and signs.
Yes.
But it impairs your day-to-day function.
Yes.
And it may not be acutely noticeable when you're young, but it builds up over time.
Yes. Yes. And it can cause a lot of problems when people are young, but yes,
yeah,
but it might not do. Mm. It might cause less obvious problems, and particularly in people who are really highly functioning, they'll tend to be able to compensate for their ADHD and their difficulties focusing. So they, particularly in earlier stages of education, they may be okay with, they might be able to manage just doing things at the last minute and not revising much. But it's usually much harder at university. And then they say, and sometimes people will say, well, the problem is I never learned how to study.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, then they're not thinking that it's a problem with the concentration or with ADHD symptoms. It's the, well, I never learned how to study because I didn't really need to study that much. And then when I did need to study, I didn't know how to do it, which may be true. But actually, the reason for that is maybe ADHD.
Get it.
So
the more you talk about it, are you not worried that everyone's going to think that they have it? I mean, so can I quote Wes Streeting? You know,
yes.
Did he recently say that there's an overdiagnosis of mental health conditions?
Yes, I think he did. I think that was in the media a couple of months ago.
From a specialist perspective, how do you view that comment?
Well, I mean, I think it's not correct. I mean, he just said mental health conditions, I think. I mean, he wasn't specifying ADHD, but even if we're looking at the rise in mental health conditions...
But he was talking about holding people back from work and things like that. Is that correct? That was my understanding.
Yes,
you really
but I...
find it,
yes,
rather than misquoting him.
But I think... There are much higher rates of mental health conditions in general now, and
but he used the word overdiagnosis. Is that helpful or unhelpful?
Well, I mean, I think it does depend on what he's talking about. But even if you're looking at mental health conditions more broadly, there have been studies showing that the reason that there are more diagnoses of mental health conditions is that there are more people with those mental health conditions. So it has, as far as I'm aware, there are studies fairly recently which showed that they reflect a true increase in the rate of those conditions, and not an overdiagnosis. And certainly for ADHD, yeah, there isn't overdiagnosis. And it's very hard to get an ADHD diagnosis. People are waiting very long time.
In this country.
In the UK.
Yeah.
Yes, particularly in England. Really long time to get an assessment on the NHS or, a very costly private assessment and also private treatment. So it's not easy to get an assessment. And there are long waiting lists. So, there isn't an overdiagnosis.
Okay. And so you're not worried. You're not worried about suddenly loads of people knocking at your door.
Well, there is very high demand for assessment, but most of those people do have ADHD, I think. So, I think people, because it is difficult to get an assessment, it's not something that people do lightly in a way. It's quite not just waiting a long time. There's a lot of paperwork, a lot of information that you have to gather. The assessment is long and, you have to be clear that you think that is a benefit to you. To get that, and that's what we're seeing. So it's not surprising that most people who come forward to have the assessment are diagnosed with ADHD, because people are self-selecting because it's really difficult to get the assessment, and particularly if they've apparently done well or not had any obvious difficulties for a long time, people might say to them, well, maybe you do, but what's the point? You don't need an assessment.
And
you don't need treatment.
To that
a lot of people will be masking those that ADHD, and it takes a toll internally. It's very tired, it's very draining. So often, so one thing that we look out for is if people are doing really well in one area mm-hmm. of their life, and the other areas it's much more difficult for them. And that's usually because maybe they're putting a lot of effort, or so much effort, into maintaining their functioning and performance at work, mm-hmm. they do not have the energy, physical or mental, to be doing the paperwork they should be doing at home, or keeping on top of the household,
or pursuing romantic relationships.
Yes, or having relationships, or doing other things outside of that. So they have to put all of that energy into one area mm-hmm. to maintain that level of function, and then they can't do that in other areas. And the other thing that's happens as people get older is the hyperactivity reduces, mm-hmm. so the energy levels essentially are a bit less. Mm. So what is also not often understood is that ADHD is actually associated with fatigue, mm-hmm. particularly in adults as people get a bit older, but also in teenagers. When you ask people about their life when they were children or teenagers, they will often say that they were quite tired, because they have this restless energy, they keep going, even though they might actually be tired. And that becomes more obvious and more prominent in adulthood. And it's, so ADHD is actually linked with conditions like chronic fatigue syndrome, people, both in young adults and in people as they get a bit older. So that's also not often understood, that you can have ADHD and have a lot of fatigue. You're not necessarily full of energy,
yeah.
but you may be restless and find it difficult to stop and relax.
Yeah.
Or you may feel like you have lots of energy. I mean, it's very,
yeah.
very variable. Yeah.
Thank you. Shall we move on to what would you like to share with your GP colleagues?
Yes, I mean, it's all really important to be aware in the UK that GPs provide most mental health care. The figure when I was training was quoted as that 80% of mental health consultations occur in GP settings. So GPs are doing a lot of work with people with mental health problems. I think what is not necessarily known as well as much is perhaps the links between ADHD and autism and other physical conditions. So as I said, things like chronic fatigue, chronic pain, fibromyalgia, those conditions are much more commonly seen in neurodivergent people. And also joint hypermobility, so Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is also more common in people with ADHD and autism. So there are a number of kind of connections to other conditions mm-hmm. where if you have a patient with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, for example, you might want to think, it might be helpful to think, well, do they have any other difficulties mm-hmm. that they might benefit from some support with? And is that, is that a neurodivergent condition or something else? So there are, I think, understanding that there's a link between some of these conditions can be helpful mm-hmm. because then you can actually start to make sense of what's happening, because you may have a patient with lots of different symptoms that don't seem to fit much a pattern perhaps, and actually they may have a neurodevelopmental condition which might explain. And so actually then if you look into that, if you look into the conditions that are linked to neurodevelopmental conditions, you might see, oh, okay, yes, so migraines and fatigue and chronic pain and PCOS, for example, in women, polycystic ovaries, those things do cluster in people who are neurodivergent. So maybe there is something more that we can help people with. They may have symptoms which can be treated, because actually I see a lot of people women who've had lots of different symptoms, and they've been to lots of doctors and lots of clinics and GPs and specialists, and they've never really got to the bottom of things, and they've just been left with this feeling, well, this is just normal, or this is just what you have to live with. And maybe it isn't, because it's not been recognised that there is an explanation and that there may be things that can help.
Sorry, you've used lots of synonyms. Can you explain? Yeah. You said neurodivergent.
Mm.
What was the other one? Neuro.
Oh, neurodevelopmental.
Yeah.
So, so ADHD is a neurodevelopmental condition, and there are a small number of those conditions. So ADHD, autism, dyslexia, dyscalculia, which is basically like dyslexia for numbers, dyspraxia, which is also called developmental coordination difficulty. So that's particularly about kind of hand-eye coordination, balance, your awareness of your body in space, but there are some other things as well. Dysgraphia, which is difficulty with handwriting. And I think that's all of them. Mm-hmm. So they cluster together. So you're actually unlikely to only have one of those. So if you have ADHD, you've probably got at least traits of another condition, and it's quite likely you've got another one of those conditions.
So if you have dyslexia?
So if you have dyslexia, then you may well have ADHD or autism or dyscalculia or dysgraphia. So if you've got, and again, this perhaps for people, for health professionals or people in education, if you have a young person or an adult with one of these conditions, particularly thinking education and dyslexia or difficulty with maths, is it dyscalculia? Does that exist on its own, or are there other difficulties which might be explainable if you look into it?
And then so autism, that's separate.
So, yeah, so autism is a separate diagnosis. It is a different condition.
Okay.
But if you have autism, we now understand that probably at least half of people and up to almost three quarters of people who are autistic also have ADHD. So there's a very strong connection between autism and ADHD.
Okay.
And until about 10 or so years ago, when the diagnostic criteria changed, it wasn't possible to be diagnosed with autism and ADHD. Mm-hmm. And now we understand that you can and commonly do have both. So there's been an enormous change in the science and understanding of these conditions. So on paper, if you look at the traits of autism and the traits of ADHD, they look very different. But in real life, in a person, it can be very difficult sometimes to know if a particular behavior or something's happening is linked to autism or ADHD. So for example, in a social setting, if someone's having difficulty reading social cues, picking up what's happening with body language or facial expressions, that might be because of ADHD and they're having difficulty paying attention. Mm-hmm. They're zoning out. Mm-hmm. Or it might be that they are paying attention, but it's really hard to actually read what that facial expression is. And that might be autism. And actually, if you have both, then that's even more difficult, because not only is it harder for your brain to recognize that what that facial expression is, it's also really hard to pay attention to it. And so that can make some of the difficulties or the impairment greater if you have both. And some of the traits kind of work kind of in opposition. So often what people say is that the most difficult thing of having autism and ADHD is the need for routine and to be able to predict what's about to happen with autism.
Autism, yeah.
And the need for novelty and change and stimulation and the dislike of routine with ADHD. And those two things cause a lot of tension. And that is commonly what people will kind of say, that is the most difficult thing when we're talking about it. It's not for everybody, but there is a lot of tension between those two different traits. But again, it's often not diagnosed. So those are the kind of the neurodevelopmental conditions which cluster together. And
so neurodivergent?
So neurodivergent. So that isn't a diagnostic term or a kind of medical term. That has come specifically as a non-medical framework to mm-hmm. see it. It's not about a disorder or deficit, it's about strengths. That's the kind of, as I understand it, the kind of ethos behind the term.
Yeah.
So it doesn't necessarily have a completely agreed set of conditions which sit within it.
Mm-hmm.
Often, and I think it's often used interchangeably with neurodevelopmental, and certainly that's the way I tend to use it. Some people might include other conditions, mm-hmm. Like mental health conditions in neurodivergent, But you, generally, people are talking about, in fact, often what they're talking actually about more about ADHD and autism, mm-hmm. and not necessarily the other neurodevelopmental conditions.
Mm-hmm. So you talk about neurodevelop. I can't even. But what's happening to the brain? So can you explain to me on a? Oh, sorry.
What neurodevelopmental means is that these conditions are present from early life.
Is the brain struggling to develop?
The brain is developing differently. So it is about the wiring of the brain, so that the brain is wired in a different way. And so people are processing information in a different way, using maybe different parts of their brain to, for example, in autism, to process social information, or where they are, where the frontal areas of the brain, which are in control, are planning and organization and the doing of complex tasks, that doesn't work as well if in ADHD. And for example, working memory is not as... people have a smaller working memory with ADHD. So there are differences in the size of some areas of the brain. So because that's how they are developing from very early life. And when we say early life, we mean from either within the womb, so before birth, or in the very early, in the first few months of life, where there is a change. So it could be, a lot of it is genetic, but then it's also about the environment. And when we talk about the environment, what we mean are things like an illness or a viral illness that, you know, a mother may have, or the baby may have, or where there's something in exposure to something in the environment, which might be a chemical or something, which we might not even know what that is. But that's what, when we say environmental factors rather than genetic, that's what we're talking about, is something which has happened very early on. Mm-hmm. Which has changed the way that the brain is developing. But I mean,
it is implicated, or it could be.
But they are very, very genetic conditions. So right. To the point,
so there's a predisposition, but then there's also maybe a trigger. Is that what you're saying? Yes,
but although it's probably even more than a predisposition, because we know ADHD is so genetic that we're now all kind of at the point that if somebody is diagnosed with ADHD, then we should be thinking about, so if they have children, do their children have ADHD? Or if they are a child, one of their parents is very likely to have ADHD. So should we be screening the parents? And this is also something which is helpful for people to understand, because people, again, often worry that their behaviour may be being transmitted to their children. Their children are learning from them what they're doing, and if they're struggling with certain things and they see that kind of emerging in their child, they think, oh, that's because I'm doing it, and they feel very bad about that. They feel guilty that they might be causing something in their child, but actually that's not the case. It's genetic. It does reflect that something's happening, but it's not something that they're doing. If they didn't do it, you know, their child wouldn't behave in that way. It's genetic. It's not about parenting either. That's also really important for people to know, that parenting style, and parenting skills are important, but those difficulties with ADHD in children cause parents to change the way that they interact with their children in order to manage the difficulties. But what's seen is that maybe it's the way that they're parenting that is causing the problem, and it's the other way around. That people are reacting to the symptoms in the child. And so that's the other thing about ADHD. It's very treatable. It doesn't go away, but it is very, very treatable. Mm. And that's the thing about, you know, you were talking earlier about getting an early diagnosis. Something that's really common for adults having an assessment is that, you know, at some point they're going to start to think, oh, well, what if this had been diagnosed earlier? How would my life have been different? But and then they start to think about the difficulties they had, and not just the clear things like maybe in exams, but also the day-to-day things of being picked on or told off by the teachers, or the reports that came from school about talking, or things where they just got in trouble or just felt bad about. Mm-hmm. And all of that could maybe that could have been different. That's the way that, you know, that's completely natural part of the process of having an assessment and a diagnosis. Mm. And so I think it is, you know, I'm not a child psychiatrist, but I think it's why it's really important to help people and children to understand what's going on. But there is a flip side where for younger people particularly, having the diagnosis and the label might make them feel worse. So I think for younger people, it's maybe not as
clear cut,
but certainly getting people support if they're having, you know, difficulties academically or at school is obviously important. But, you know, it's a really complicated, I mean, this is why I would say to people, you know, if you think this would be helpful for you, then we should think about doing the assessment. Mm-hmm. They don't have to have it right there and then, you know, when they've come to see me, they can... Mm-hmm. And even if they have an assessment, they don't have to go on and have treatment at that point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have the assessment, they've got the diagnosis, they can come back and or see and have treatment at another point if they think that's what they would like to do then. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be now or never.
Mm-hmm. So neuroplasticity, mm-hmm. that's about being able to change or utilize different parts of the brain for a different function. So can that still work in these neurodevelopmental conditions? Can you utilize that? Because that's what we use for rehabilitation. You know, in stroke, say, for example.
Yeah, yes. So, yeah, that's a really good question.
Like the therapies that you offer for ADHD, and I'm not going to go into the other conditions, but do they harness that approach?
I mean, they do, I suppose, in the sense that all therapy, mm-hmm. all mental health therapy, that is what it is using. Mm-hmm. I mean, if there wasn't neuroplasticity, so if the brain couldn't change in response to new information or new experiences, mm-hmm. therapy wouldn't work. Mm-hmm. Medication probably wouldn't work either. So there is still neuroplasticity, but in adults, we don't have evidence that you can change the structure of the brain that way. There is evidence in children, actually, of mm-hmm. treatment with medication for ADHD, specifically with stimulants, that over time the differences in the size of brain regions, so which are smaller in children with ADHD compared to without ADHD, so particularly the frontal areas of the brain, those do normalize over time.
With daily medication?
Yeah, over a long period of time, so years. So mm-hmm. I think some of the studies I looked at was maybe up to 10 years of medication, mm-hmm. I think. But there's quite a lot of studies that show that, and we don't have the evidence for that in adults, but it may work. That may be the case.
And adults access or take the medication slightly differently. Do they take it when they need it?
It depends on the medications, but stimulants can be taken that way. Mm-hmm. And I think that the way of taking it probably comes from education and young people who would take it for school, and maybe particularly younger children. Certainly, when I was training a long time ago now, children might have a break from medication in the holidays because ADHD medication in children can affect growth, mm-hmm. And height.
What growth
height. So, you know, that has to be monitored. But in adults, it can be taken every day, but it can be taken when it's needed. But it depends what you're taking it for. So taking it as needed makes sense if you're taking it to be productive, to focus and get tasks done. But actually stimulants are really helpful for the emotional symptoms of ADHD, which in studies people report as being some of the most difficult symptoms. They cause the most distress and often a lot of impairment. And stimulants are actually really effective. And, you know, what I say to people is, you know, the difficulty there is you don't know necessarily if it's going to be a stressful day or not.
What are the emotional symptoms?
So the emotional symptoms of ADHD are things like anxiety, low mood, but particularly difficulty regulating mood, and rejection sensitivity. So that's, again, it's not a strictly medical term, but rejection sensitivity dysphoria, which is often people talk about on social media. And this is a significant sensitivity to a rejection, or what's seen or felt as a rejection. So the way that this might be felt is someone being very, very sensitive to criticism. So, and again, the sensitivity may not be shown. So they may not outwardly react, but the way I would explain it to people is that they take it very personally. When is there any slight kind of criticism or feedback about something, it just feels, really awful. Mm. And it kind of gets amplified in the head. They really think, get stuck on it. Mm. And in relationships, that can be really intense. And so often that can be mistaken for other mental health conditions. So particularly in women, emotionally unstable personality disorder can be misdiagnosed when it's actually the rejection sensitivity that comes with ADHD. And though that rejection sensitivity then often triggers emotional changes, so emotional reaction. Mm-hmm. And stimulants are really effective at kind of helping people to have a more stable mood, to be less sensitive. So again, this is not a diagnostic criterion, but people-pleasing is something that people with ADHD often describe. And again, people talk about it a lot on social media or online. And this difficulty with boundaries, essentially, becomes a lot easier often when people take stimulants. And it just, people come back to the clinic, they've been on medication for a few weeks, and they will just say, yes, and they will just say that it's kind of happened spontaneously. People just tend to feel more at ease within themselves, and it's much easier to say, oh no, I don't really want to do that, and just kind of, that's where the thing stops. Because ADHD is about overthinking. That's the other aspect why it'd be difficult to pick up, that this is just overthinking, constantly thinking, what if this, what if this, what if that. And so if you say no to somebody, oh well, what will they think of me, should I have done that? And again, difficulty making decisions is part of the psychological experience of ADHD, the uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And so that just gets amplified and magnified. Whereas with the stimulants, it just kind of keeps thoughts a bit more on a kind of a sequence. So there's less branching off of what if this, what if that. It's mm-hmm. a bit quieter. So they can say, no, I don't think I'm going to do that. And then stop and think about something else. Whereas okay. without the medication, they may be really stuck on what are they going to think, and I should have done it, and oh, I've got, I need to do it.
Got it. Thank you. And finally, what would you like to share with your specialist colleagues? And I think did I prompt you to talk about ADHD in doctors?
Yeah, and I think that's helpful. And the things that people might do to help, I mean, will apply to people who aren't doctors as well, but I think...
Oh yeah, tips, sorry, that was it. Yeah, I wanted to know about non-pharmaceutical...
Yeah, yes.
Treatment modalities. Yes,
and I think, so just briefly on medication, before we move on to the non-medication, I suppose just to say that, medication doesn't work for everybody, but ADHD treatments are incredibly effective. Uh-huh. And they are some of the most effective treatments for any condition at all in healthcare. So in terms of...
You're selling it.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the proportion of people that improve and the degree that their symptoms improve, they're extremely effective. So up to 80% of people have a very good response to treatment. Okay. And so the majority of people I see do respond well to medication. It has to be prescribed carefully, and you need to think about what is the right medication, what is the right dose, and how quickly to increase the dose. Mm-hmm. A lot of people I've seen have had problems because actually it's been increased too quickly, mm-hmm. And they have lots of side effects, but it's just the way that it's been done. Okay. I mean, it might be that people don't want medication, or they maybe because of their physical health it's not suitable for them, in which case we'd use the other options. But ideally, you would think about medication and adaptations and using productivity techniques, but also maybe having some coaching or some psychological therapy to help either with emotional symptoms or things like perfectionism or other mm-hmm. strategies. So
So it's the perfectionism that I was going to pick you up on.
It is something that we ask about, but it's not a symptom in itself. But I haven't ever seen anybody with ADHD who doesn't have perfectionism.
Sorry,
actually.
Say that again. You haven't?
I've never seen anyone with ADHD who doesn't have perfectionism so far. Because it seems to be so kind of core to the experience of, trying to make things better. So, and perfectionism is not about being perfect. I mean, it's not perfect. That's the point. You have to, things are just not good enough. You always have to try and make it better. But you can have perfectionism and not have ADHD. Mm-hmm. But I think, yes, so a lot of doctors are perfectionists in that way. They're trying to always make it better and holding themselves to an unrealistic standard and taking things, taking on a lot of responsibility. Yes, because I think the difficulty with perfectionism is if it's not really clear, like you A, B, C, D, E, that's what you do, then how do you know it's good? Particularly if you have that trait, I think that's the lack of clarity perhaps about what is expected sometimes. And I think which there is a lot of that in medicine. Yes. And also because the stakes are really high.
Are there any useful techniques in the ADHD non-pharmaceutical management that are useful for us to know about?
Yeah, I mean, there are lots
to apply to our daily lives.
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of different techniques. And I think what is important is that people, this goes for anybody, is you just have to find what works for you. Mm-hmm. You need to look at lots of different techniques and try them out. And again, just take a more kind of curious, or try and take a more curious stance. It's not like you should be doing it right. You should be doing this and this should work. It's just thinking, well, let me try and see if this is helpful. And if it's not helpful, okay, well, I will try something else and I will find something. Or you can adapt it as well if it doesn't quite work for you. So you need to make it work for you. That's the really crucial thing. I mean, particularly for doctors, a structured kind of process for prioritizing things, as far as I've seen online.
Yeah.
I've only ever seen one thing which really made me think about productivity in terms of not doing things. So all the productivity things online or that are published are usually about prioritizing things. There's very little about how to decide whether something is a task or not. And particularly if you have ADHD, you'll constantly be thinking of things that you could be doing. There's not much I've seen available about how to decide whether to do something or not. So you need a way of deciding whether to do things. And that could be just constantly reprioritizing. Mm-hmm. And after a while, you just take things. If I haven't done this in 4 weeks, I just take it off the list.
Spin it.
Yeah, that's one way of doing it. And that's absolutely fine. You might do it a different way, but you do need to take things off the list. That's okay. The other, take things off the list that you have not done.
Okay.
Just say, I'm not going to do that. And that's really difficult if you have ADHD, actually, say, I'm not going to do it. There's one particular website that I direct people to, which I can share.
Yes, please. Do you mind sharing now?
And it's all called attitudemag.com. So it's attitudemag.com. And I can give you the link. And that has a lot of information about ADHD, about different therapies, about medication, about productivity. It's an American website, but it's written for patients. It's also got quite a lot of information about childhood ADHD and information for parents. It's a really good resource for adults and parents and children and young people. Right. So that is the place that I recommend that people start. Mm-hmm. And then have a look at the different techniques. There's lots of different, quite simple things. And just have a look and see which ones kind of appeal to you, which ones do you think would fit with what you're doing and the way that you already work that you would like to try, and go from there. And then once, because you've learned, you will see those different ways of doing things and specific techniques, and then you can kind of go from there, and you'll find your way essentially. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of apps, but again, you just have to find what's the right thing for you.
Don't fight don't struggle with this new technique if it doesn't work for you.
If it doesn't chime with the way that you think and the way that you work and what you need to do,
okay,
then it's not going to work. And again, some people find that a simple paper list is the best thing to do. It's really personal preference, and also it might change over time. So again, that's the thing to bear in mind. It's okay if it works now, but then it doesn't work in a few months' time. That's okay. And really, things like what we talk about, self-care, you know, sleep, exercise, nutrition, they're completely fundamental to managing ADHD in the long term.
Mm-hmm.
And I always encourage people to look at some kind of mindful practice, whether it's meditation or yoga or Tai Chi or breathwork or something that suits them,
mm-hmm.
and try and build something in, because helping to regulate the nervous system as well as kind of help to kind of calm the mind is really important, because ADHD is it's essentially about dysregulation. So it's a difficulty with regulation of concentration, when to concentrate, what to concentrate on, when to sleep, difficulty regulating appetite, regulating energy levels. So things which help the nervous system to regulate itself, like yoga or breathwork or meditation, can be very helpful. And we know that they are generally
so the
helpful.
More tools you have.
Yes, and try and put some structure.
Yeah.
Find what's the right thing for you at this time, knowing that if you're doing a different job in 5 years' time, and you know you're living in a different place, or maybe you have children in 5 years' time and you don't know, life will be different, whatever it is. You will need something different. That's fine. That also be able to say to you, if that's okay, that it won't work then, or it doesn't work all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to work enough of the time, and it needs to be something that you can incorporate and find some structure. And I think finding structure is also really difficult with ADHD. An external structure, and this is another reason that ADHD in adults may not become apparent early on, because there's a lot more structure in early childhood. So if you think about education, the structure is progressively removed. You need to do more and more self-motivated, self-directed work as you go from primary to secondary to GCSE, A-level degree if you go on to university, and then into employment where there's even less structure and you have to get on with things. And that's what's really difficult. So external structure, if you're relying on yourself to motivate yourself to go to the gym or to fill in that form, that is really, really difficult. If you've got an appointment, if you've decided you're going to meet your friend in the park to go for a run, or you've booked a personal trainer, you're much more likely to go and do it than if you've got it in your list of things, I'm going to get up at 8 o'clock tomorrow and go for a run in the park. That's really hard to do at 8 o'clock in the morning when you wake up. It's easier if you know that your friend has also got up and they are waiting for you, or you paid to see a personal trainer, then you're much more likely to do it. And so use that. You put in the structure, like that external structure, when you can, to help you build stuff around it. Because it's harder to not just build a routine, but it's harder to keep the routine.
Okay.
If you have ADHD.
Schedule a cleaner. Come weekly, then you could do your pre-clean, if anything. And then
I think if you can... And obviously that's going to vary a lot for people, but really just offload as many of these tasks from yourself as you can. So outsource. So does it need to be done? B, does it need to be done by you? And is it possible that, you know, it could be done a different way? So if you don't have to do it yourself, what are the options? Rather than feeling that you must do all of these things. Because it's really difficult. So just stop doing things. It's very easy to say. Stop doing things that you don't need to do, and try not to do things that you don't like, actually. If you don't like if you're doing something at work that you don't like, is it possible you could change to do something that you do like? Because that's going to be easier and more rewarding, obviously. But, you know, think about, do I have to do this?
You're saying, if I don't like it, get an accountant to do it.
If you can, yes. I mean, certainly not saying don't do your tax, don't do it if you don't like it. But if you can get an accountant to do it, think about, is that the best use of your money and time, if that's possible for you? If you have to do your own tax return, are there other things that you're doing that you maybe you don't have to do, that you, so whatever it is, just try and minimize those things. We all have to do things that we don't want to do.
Mm-hmm. But for ADHD, why is it more important?
Because those things are much harder to do and to do consistently. So what I was trying to help or try and get people to start to think about is, yeah, firstly, does it need to be done? Secondly, then, do you need to do it? Because those things just get merged. It's not, people don't question whether they need to do it often. They just think they're just struggling because they've been struggling to do it. So they keep trying to do it. And so my question is always, well, do you need to do it?
Okay.
Is there an alternative option where it could be done in a different way that would make your life simpler and easier? So all the things that are essential are done, but not necessarily by you.
Got it.
Now that, you know,
isn't that
different.
Obvious? Well, maybe it's not obvious, but I think as a doctor, as a professional, you're delegating to so many people. You're like, yeah, that task junior doctor or resident doctor can do, secretary can do that, receptionist can do that.
Well, it's...
But with ADHD, they're struggling even then to...
Yeah, I mean, I think that it will... I mean, obviously, as I said, these things vary enormously, but delegating might be difficult if you're... if you have perfectionism, or if you're struggling to kind of keep on top of your tasks, it can actually be harder to delegate, I think. But also with ADHD, there are the what we call the executive problems, so the organising and planning. But the executive problems also include how people think about problems and how they understand themselves. So it isn't obvious. If you have an executive problem, people will tend to keep doing the same, trying to do the same thing. I'm going to get up tomorrow morning and go for a run. I'm going to go, okay, well, I'll try and go tomorrow. Okay, well, I'll try and go to the next day. And they, you know, they try and do it and they think, well, I just need to get up and go for a run. But if you're trying to get up and go for a run for 2 weeks in a row every day and you're not going, people blame themselves, think I should go. Whereas I would try and reframe that as, well, you are not going. So why? What is getting in the way? And people, it's really, really difficult for people to think about that.
Yeah.
Because what they tend to do is just repeat the same thing.
Yeah.
And this is part of the ADHD. Otherwise, they would be able to do
some things.
Yeah. I think it's really difficult to.
The reason I said that is because I don't have empathy. It's because. It's really just to state from, if you're a friend or an onlooker, don't think these things are obvious.
No, of course,
you know,
exactly.
Talking through how you do this and that.
Yes.
Even though you're in your 40s, and it's still useful to share these tips.
Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, I think it's not obvious, is it? And these things, you know, it's not that they're all of these things were immediately always obvious to me either. Mm. These are things that I've also learned and through my work and working with people, that what can help. And actually noticing there's the pattern of, like, you keep doing this, trying to do the same thing and it doesn't work.
Mm.
But it's really hard to then take a step back and think, well, what could be done differently? What is the block? And what can we put in place or trying something new?
Mm.
And that flexibility to try and experiment without feeling like that you're, again, it comes a lot to the perfectionism that you're failing, you're not doing it right. Everybody else can get up and go for a run tomorrow morning, so just get up and go for a run.
Mm.
But that's not working. So what would work instead?
Yeah.
And that's really difficult to do, actually. So those are the kind of practices that if you start to learn them, then you can develop that skill to solve problems in a different way some of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's not going to work 100% of the time.
Mm-hmm. So is there a therapy that you can, that you refer to so people can learn these skills?
Well, coaching for ADHD can be really, really helpful. And that... Yeah. Does particularly tend to focus on these more practical things, although it does also look at ways of managing kind of the emotional things aspects as well. It doesn't necessarily have to be just on practical productivity, but that tends to be around those structure and routine implementing things. Right. And then there was psychological therapy. So there is CBT, cognitive behavior therapy, which can be helpful for things like perfectionism or applying certain techniques. Mm-hmm. The therapy that I and a lot of my colleagues tend to use a lot is DBT, dialectic mm-hmm. behavior therapy, mm-hmm. Which is a skills-based therapy. So it's teaching people skills, mainly about recognizing emotions and managing distress, emotional intensity, and then also helping with self-regulation, and which can help with like routines around sleep and meditation and mindfulness. And that really helps with emotional regulation, but it also helps with some of the executive things. And so people can often get a lot of benefit from that therapy, or people may also benefit from having some trauma-focused therapy. So again, it in terms of the therapy, it will depend on what other difficulties people might have and things that we might have discussed with anxiety or mood problems and things like that. So, but DBT is a very helpful therapy. I think that's probably the single most useful therapy overall. In my experience.
For ADHD or just for other things as well?
I would say, for ADHD, and I particularly for autism, but it's a very effective therapy for, you know, anxiety and mood problems, actually. But it depends on the individual, not just kind of the difficulties that they've been having, but also the style of therapy that they prefer, mm-hmm. because that's really important. Mm-hmm. So, there's coaching, which is more focused on the productivity aspects, mm-hmm. and then for other things can be looked at in therapy, which is kind of more dependent on the individual. But there are lots of different options, and you can learn really so much about yourself by looking at resources. And there's some really good things on social media, actually. I mean, particularly there's a few on YouTube that I've seen of people talking about their ADHD and explaining their experiences and their day-to-day experiences, and they really help to
articulate
communicate
it,
yes, to people with or without ADHD. So I think, you know, really learning about it is, it can't be stressed how useful and helpful that is for people and for
shared experiences,
families or colleagues, friends, to get an insight into, you know, what it's like, because people with ADHD are usually working really hard to manage their symptoms and to not forget things and not be late and not be too loud. People, that's the other thing. People have maybe told that they're too loud, or that they're too much. This is one of the things that people say. Yes, I was always told I was too much. And that's really painful if you're being told that you're being too boisterous, too loud, too intense, you're too much. That's a really painful thing to internalize, and then to have to try and suppress that all of the time. So it's really hard for people to manage the symptoms and to kind of try and fit in with what people expect. And then if they try and, you know, when people might express some of the difficulties, then, you know, a lot of people don't understand, or, you know, not necessarily even accept that ADHD is a condition, or that it's a condition that needs to be prioritized, that it's a significant problem.
And especially to educate friends and family.
And I think, and there's a really great resource on YouTube, which is slightly more academic, kind of explaining ADHD and looking at research papers and different aspects of ADHD and treatments. But it's really accessible to the wider public as well by a psychologist in the States called Russell Barkley. And his YouTube channel is absolutely fantastic. It's a brilliant resource to understand and to really get to and see grips with the detail of it in a really quite accessible way.
Thank you, Nick.
I would just like to express, I think, for people who decide that an assessment for ADHD is the right thing for them, mm-hmm. although it's a challenging process, you know, to adjust to a diagnosis, actually, at mm-hmm. times, but the treatment for ADHD, or even not having treatment but having a diagnosis, often is life-changing. So it helps people to really take control of their life, whether that's with medication or whether that's through, as we've been talking about, other options. It's not necessarily the right path for every person, and people can decide for themselves if it's what they want, if it's right for them. But I think it's important to think about, listen to yourself. If you think that you do have difficulties, they may be relating to ADHD, even if people around you might not really understand that, or maybe some of the professionals you speak to may not all understand it, I would encourage people to pursue that.
So at least have a consultation, right? Mm. It's not as though you're pursuing a diagnosis, but you're accessing help from a psychiatrist who understands many, many conditions and who can signpost you accordingly.
Yes. And if you've read a lot about ADHD and you think that you have ADHD, then you can say that, and I would encourage people to explain, you know, why they think they might have ADHD. And the person that they're talking to can say, oh, yes, well, that does sound like ADHD. Or no, well, perhaps it's something else.
Practically speaking, and it's not that I'm trying to push patients to consult with clinicians privately, but practically speaking, if you don't want to wait, or you don't want to go through the hurdles that maybe the NHS put up for you, can you see a psychiatrist and do it in one appointment?
I think some clinics do it in that way. It can be done in that way.
Yeah.
I don't do it in that way. I will always see people for an initial discussion, consultation, and then the specific ADHD assessment. Mm-hmm. But the initial consultation is part of it, because all the information that we gather is still is relevant to the specific ADHD assessment. But the other thing to understand, though, is that it's not necessarily, in fact, going to help you get more timely access to NHS treatment, because you probably in most areas will be reassessed by the NHS if you want to have access to treatment. And if you're having medication prescribed by a private psychiatrist, your psychiatrist can ask your GP to do what's called a shared care agreement, where your GP would prescribe when you're stable on the treatment and you would see the psychiatrist every few months. But actually that is getting harder to do. And there's it's not always possible. So there's no guarantee that you will be able to have treatment, and private treatment is expensive. So that's the other reason I suggest people think about it. You know, what is the purpose of that assessment? Yeah, you may have a lot of cost, and you might not get, you might not be able to transfer that to the NHS. So you might decide that isn't worth doing. You'd rather, you know, there are wait for the NHS. But again, this is why it's really difficult to weigh up kind of the long waits versus the costs and the systems that don't necessarily link smoothly from the patient's
point of view. Do insurance companies cover the assessment?
Some of them some of them do, but not many.
Okay.
And they very rarely cover treatment. It's quite complicated to work out from the patient point of view how to get this.
Or even from the clinician's point of view, when patients ask me. I don't know.
It is really complicated.
It's easy enough to get the assessment on the NHS. You can go to your GP just saying that I think I have ADHD. Can I have an assessment, in theory?
Yeah, so your GP can refer you to your NHS ADHD service, but that's where the waits, long waits are. They're very variable. I've been told recently by patients that they've been told that they will have to wait 8 years. So the waits are extremely long.
8 years?
That's what some patients have told me recently, yeah. So, I mean, the waits are extremely long. And this is that's why there was the NHS England recently published an interim report, because they're looking at this difficulty, which is that the number of people being referred for assessment is very, very high, and it far outstrips, you know, the capacity to provide the assessments. And this is why, you know, even in private practice, there are often waits to be seen to have ADHD assessments. It's not so, I mean, it's shorter, but there are very long waits.
How much is the cost of medication per year?
I mean, it varies depending on the medication.
For an average patient?
So for the most common stimulant, you're probably spending at least £100 a month, maybe £120 a month, because it depends on the dose, and some people mm-hmm. need more than one medication. Mm-hmm. But that becomes quite expensive, and particularly if you're taking it every day and you may be taking that for, you know, a number of years.
Okay. Thank you so much for coming.
No, thank you.
I hope this recording will be useful.
Yeah, so do I.
Yeah.
So thank you.
It's a pleasure. Yeah. Mm. Okay. Thank you, Nick.
Oh, thanks, Brenda.
So we were just chatting and I was about to let you go. But then I've stopped you from going, and I said, please, can we capture this clinical pearl that you were sharing with me?
Yeah. So I suppose one of the things about part of an ADHD assessment is that one of the criteria is whether the symptoms could be explained by something else. So people do need to have a general mental health assessment to see, you know, that to make sure that the symptoms are likely to be explained by ADHD. So one of the things that I'd be looking for is whether there is another condition, particularly a serious condition, mental health condition that might look like ADHD. So one of the things particularly that you would want to exclude or clarify is whether the patient might have bipolar disorder or ADHD, because the mood instability
could be explained,
and
by
the energy variations might sound like, it could look like either. It's very difficult actually to make a diagnosis of bipolar disorder unless someone's had a very clear kind of manic episode. But you can have a hypomania, which is less severe, so where people are not sleeping, they may not be eating much, they have lots of energy, racing thoughts, very talkative, lots of plans for the future, unrealistic plans when they look back. And then they have periods of kind of depressed mood. And with ADHD, there is a lot of variability because of the dysregulation. People do have times where their mood is higher. They may be almost elevated in mood beyond the normal kind of range of mood. They may be talking quickly. They might have more plans, or they may be carrying out their kind of plans more because they're focused and excited, and then the energy will reduce, and they will have difficulty with motivation and procrastination. And so there is this variability, but usually the variability is within a narrower range, and it's much more short-lived. So there, with ADHD, that variation is likely to happen through one day, or maybe for a couple of days. Whereas with hypomania, what we're talking about is difficulty sleeping, or a significant reduction in sleep with high energy and pressured speech, which is so rapid it's difficult to interrupt it, and racing thoughts, kind of grandiose or so, ideas, kind of slightly unrealistic views of what they can achieve or of themselves, which can last for at least a few days, so about a week or a bit longer. But it can sometimes be difficult to distinguish it. Okay. And I've certainly seen people where I've thought, this sounds like ADHD. Mm-hmm. And actually then when I've seen them, by the end of the consultation, I think, actually, no, this does sound like maybe bipolar disorder type 2, which is the kind of less severe type of bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. And I've certainly seen a few patients where, young people, where I've started them on a mood stabilizer instead of proceeding, you know, of doing an ADHD assessment, and they've got a lot better very quickly.
Okay. And so the medication that way around is okay, but the clinical part that I wanted to capture was...
Ah, okay, yes. So you don't want to prescribe a stimulant to somebody who has bipolar disorder if they're not on treatment for bipolar disorder. So because you may precipitate a manic episode.
Okay.
And there is an increased risk of psychosis is a side effect of stimulants if you have a psychotic illness, so psychosis or bipolar disorder, which is not treated. But actually, conversely, if you have bipolar disorder and ADHD, which is actually fairly common,
if you have
both ADHD and bipolar disorder, which is not uncommon,
Okay. Actually,
you are much more likely to have bipolar disorder if you have ADHD. So if you have both, then the bipolar disorder is more difficult to treat unless you treat the ADHD. So in fact, treatment with a mood stabilizer and an ADHD medication is better. But what you don't want to do is give someone a stimulant on its own without a mood stabilizer if they have a serious mood disorder, because it's going to cause more instability. In the same way that you also don't want to give them prescribe an antidepressant without a mood stabilizer, because that also makes bipolar disorder worse.
Yeah.
So that is one of the, yeah, that's a key thing that you want to...
Well, I found it interesting, pulled you from outside into back onto the sofa to hit record. So thank you, Nick.
You're welcome.